Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest this morning is former Speaker of the House and many believe a likely candidate for president, Newt Gingrich. He also has a new book called Pearl Harbor, A Novel of December 8th, and he's making two bookstore appearances in our area tonight at 7:30 at The Borders at 290 Commons Way in Bridgewater, and tomorrow night at 7 at the Barnes & Noble at 2245 Richmond Avenue on Staten Island. Mr. Gingrich, welcome back to WNYC.
Well, it's great to be back with you.
Let's start with Pearl Harbor. You call your approach active history. What does that mean?
Well, we try to find a change that could have occurred that was reasonable and that might have had a dramatic impact on the actual outcome. And the reason we do that is we want people to understand that history, when you're living it forward, is unknowable. All too often, people look back and they memorize things and they assume that it was inevitable that it was going to happen that way. We had a very successful series on the Civil War called Gettysburg, Grant Comes East, and Never Call Retreat, where we outlined what might have happened if could Lee have won at Gettysburg, and if he had won at Gettysburg, how might that have affected things. Now at Pearl Harbor, we've asked a different question. We've said, what might have happened if Admiral Yamamoto, the leading Japanese architect of naval aviation, a man who believed in gambling, who'd actually made a good bit of money in Monaco gambling when he was on a European trip, and who was a brilliant strategist, what if he had gone forward with the Japanese fleet opposite Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, and instead of having a relatively timid battleship admiral, Admiral Nagumo, what if they had had Admiral Yamamoto in charge? And we show how, given the success of the initial attack, they might have had a pretty free hand to do dramatically greater damage to Pearl Harbor and dramatically greater damage to the American fleet, and that might have then made the Pacific War much more complicated on the American side. So it's an effort to get people to think about what various possibilities are and to wrap it into a novel so that it's interesting and there's a real story and you get engaged in talking about what might have happened.
What's the lesson for you in that particular alternative history?
Well, I think the first lesson is that intelligence can fail. We were actually reading the Japanese diplomatic code. We had a pretty good sense of what they were saying, and yet we misread what was going on. We thought they might attack in the Philippines or in Hong Kong or Malaya, but we had no idea that they were going to attack us at Pearl Harbor. So intelligence can fail. You need to have a strong national security and homeland security in case it does fail. Second, you may completely misread your opponent. We really fundamentally misunderstood the Japanese, and they fundamentally misunderstood us. And I think sometimes when you look at North Korea, Iran, Syria, Al-Qaeda, you're looking at a similar mismatch of cultures in which we apply one set of rules and one set of logic, and our opponents apply a totally different set. And then third, technology really matters. The Japanese had mastered refueling at sea. They had mastered a very powerful air force based on carriers, and they had developed a very shallow torpedo that enabled them to go into Pearl Harbor and drop torpedoes from aircraft and have them be effective. All of those things represented a technological capability that we underestimated. And I think when you look at nuclear and biological weapons, when you look at the terrorists of today, you have to worry that they're going to gain some kind of technological breakthrough that will make life much, much more dangerous.
Obviously, people today hear Pearl Harbor and they think September 11th. Did you write the book specifically to draw parallels?
Well, we wrote the book for two big reasons. One was to draw parallels with modern America, and the other was to get people looking at Asia, looking at the Pacific, recognizing that Americans have to learn a lot more about Japan, China, India, Singapore, Malaya, Indonesia, Australia. But in terms of today's lessons, it's very clear if you read Pearl Harbor that the democracies in the 1930s had a very hard time dealing with dictatorship, a very hard time dealing with danger, a very hard time dealing with evil in the world, and that there was a tendency to hide and to think you could somehow get by with everything working and not having to confront these problems. I would suggest if you look at the six terrorists that were picked up in New Jersey last week, there are a lot of lessons to be learned about how much we are still hiding from the reality of danger and how much we're going to have to change things if we're going to have any chance of being successful in protecting ourselves and in defeating terrorism.
What do you think needs to change?
Well, there are two immediate changes. The first is that there's a real danger that the shopkeeper who turned these people in is going to get sued, just as the people who turned in the Islamic radicals who were flying on an airplane in Minneapolis are also facing lawsuits. So Congress ought to pass a law that protects you. If you think, as our first line of defense, you as a citizen believe you see something dangerous, we want you to turn it in, and we want you to be free of any legal liability if you do turn somebody in for suspicious behavior. Second, three of the six terrorists were here illegally for 6 years. They encountered the police 54 times over that period. They never connected the person they'd picked up with the fact that they were here illegally. So there were 54 opportunities to intercept these people who were here illegally, and it never happened. And Washington should pass some very, very strong laws changing the entire pattern so that in the future, if we pick up somebody who's here illegally, we check to find out that they are here illegally. It's an absurdity that you had 6 years after, or 5 years after 9/11, that you had, you know, in the New York area, six people who were planning terrorism to kill as many Americans as they can, according to the FBI. And after 54 encounters with the police, we only caught them because a store clerk noticed their videos and decided to take the risk of calling them in.
Newt Gingrich is my guest on WNYC. His new book with William Fortune, with whom he also wrote Alternative Histories About the Civil War, is called Pearl Harbor, a novel of December 8th. He'll be doing appearances in our area tonight at 7:30 at the Borders, 290 Commons Way in Bridgewater, and tomorrow night at 7 at the Barnes & Noble at 2245 Richmond Avenue on Staten Island. If I can go on to some other issues, you've been proposing some innovative debate ideas for the presidential candidates, and I think my listeners tend to be very interested in alternatives like these and very dissatisfied with the debates that we have now. So will you tell our listeners what you have in mind?
Well, let me say, first of all, that I was very, very honored that Governor Mario Cuomo agreed, and we did an event at Cooper Union a few weeks ago here in New York City, and we talked about having real dialogue. I mean, this current process of sort of the American Idol model of 10 or 11 or 12 or 15 people standing at microphones to be allowed to answer 30 seconds on what they would do about Iraq or health care or something is an absurdity. And we proposed a genuine dialogue, 90 minutes with a moderator and I mean, with a timekeeper and no moderator, modeled really on the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which were 7 3-hour debates. Next year is the 150th anniversary, one of the great moments in American government and leadership. Interestingly, Marvin Kalb has been teaching at Harvard, and back in 1991 had a commission which also proposed something similar to what I've suggested, and that is 9 90-minute dialogues. And I would challenge every candidate in both parties to commit right now that if they get to be their party's nominee, that they would agree to 9 appearances from Labor Day through the election, one a week, for 90 minutes with a timekeeper but no moderator, so we could turn in as citizens and we could watch two adults discussing America's future, offering us their solutions, letting us understand what they would do. I think it would make for a much healthier, a more positive, and a more solution-oriented political process. And I really fear that this sort of having people stand up there as applicants with the TV commentator in charge, cutting them off, treating them disrespectfully, asking them fairly dumb questions, I think this demeans the whole office of the presidency and weakens our ability to produce leaders for the future.
And I could just about guarantee you that if anybody takes you up on those 9 one-on-one issue-oriented debates, that we will air them in full on this radio station.
That would be great. But it would be a real service to the country.
The problem is right now, you know, you have 8 candidates, you have 10 candidates. You think something better could be done under this circumstance?
Sure. I mean, I have a round robin. Have two on two. And furthermore, break it up. Don't let them just talk all the Democrats in one room attacking Republicans and all the Republicans in another room attacking Democrats. That process guarantees so much partisanship and so much bitterness that by the time we finally get nominees, they're so far apart, we can't get anything done as a country. Why don't you mix it up? Why don't you have Senator Clinton debate Governor Romney and have Senator Edwards debate Senator McCain, and have Senator Obama debate Mayor Giuliani. I mean, have a very interesting process of dialogue and have it be 90 minutes. Again, you have a radio station. I mean, there are lots of venues in America that would give them an opportunity to chat just one-on-one, to have a real, and it doesn't have to be a debate. It's not a gotcha kind of game. It's what do you think America has to solve, and what would you do as a leader to solve it, and what are your principles and your ideas for getting there? It was interesting.
So you've been talking about this for, I guess, at least a month, probably a lot more than that. That's about when I became aware of it. Have any of the existing candidates expressed an interest or a commitment to doing that kind of thing if their opponents will?
Well, Cooper Union has extended an opportunity for all of them to come and give a major, serious, substantive talk. I'm told that Mayor Giuliani is probably going to do that, and I believe it's possible that Senator Edwards is going to go do it. I think that's a starting point. I was hoping that the Des Moines Register would host a series of bipartisan events in Iowa and really draw them out of their partisan shells, mm-hmm. and get them on the same stage talking with each other. And I just think you'd have a much different kind of process if we were willing to do that.
Let me touch a couple other things. I was reading online this morning the text of your speech last Friday to the Republican Jewish Coalition. And if the text was right, you talked about building a new center-right coalition around ideas you're calling American solutions. Want to pick out a specific one or two?
Well, sure. I've talked about green conservatism. I think it's possible to use the marketplace, to use incentives, to use science and technology, to encourage entrepreneurs to develop better solutions for the environment, better solutions for energy. I was just visited this morning when I was at Good Morning America. I had a couple come and visit me who are developing an ability to build houses that have zero carbon loading in the atmosphere. They combine solar power with really, really good insulation, so they have a very low energy house, and it's a terrific breakthrough in the right direction. I was talking with the Speaker of the House in Virginia who passed a bill which created a conservation tax credit which you were allowed to transfer so that he really incentivized people who had a lot of land but not much money to put a good bit of their land in conservation easements and help the environment. And I think green conservatism is an example where you can start having a new approach, a new method for dealing with the environment that could do better, I think. If your choice is more tax, more trial lawyers, more regulators, more red tape, higher taxes, or more incentives, more prizes for new innovation, more entrepreneurs, more science and technology, I think we can come up with a better solution than the one that we see coming from the left.
I saw another solution from that speech. You mentioned price and quality transparency for the healthcare system.
Well, I think that if you go to healthtransformation.net, which is our Center for Health Transformation, which is a nonpartisan center that is developing a whole new generation of solutions, we believe every citizen should have the right to know price and quality information before they make a decision in healthcare. And so we think that it's very, very important that we develop new approaches. I would urge our listeners, you can go look at myfloridarx.com and floridacomparecare.gov. These are two websites that Governor Jeb Bush created. Myfloridarx.com allows you, if you're in Florida, to put in any of the 100 most frequently purchased drugs and a zip code, and every local drugstore comes up from the most recent, from the lowest price to the highest price, and gives you an opportunity to know exactly how much money you can save. It turned out in Fort Lauderdale that the price range was 300%. That is exactly the same drug. You could buy it at the least expensive place, or you could pay three times as much if you went to the most expensive place in the same town. So that's an example where price information and quality information begins to really help us get the cost of health care under control.
We have a few more minutes with former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. His new book is A Novel of December 8th. That's the subtitle. The title is Pearl Harbor. He's making a couple of appearances in our area today and tomorrow. I do want to mention the criticism of you that came up from our previous guests. Maybe you even heard it when you were waiting to get on the air. New York Democratic City Councilman Eric Gioia and an anti-hunger activist named Joel Berg, who are looking for more generous food stamp allocations in the new farm bill. And they said that you and your speaker were very responsible for cutting food stamp allocations at that time. Want to respond?
Sure. We never touched food stamp allocations for the very poor. But we did have welfare reform, which encouraged people to go to work and to go to school. And the fact is 65% of the people who are on welfare went to work or went to school. Today they have higher incomes. They have more stable lives. They have there's less child abuse. They have a much better future. And I would argue that we are a wealthy enough country. We can help the very poor get food. But we then want to make sure we help the very poor also acquire the habits of work and the knowledge necessary to work. And we want to help them get off of welfare and get into the economy. And I'd be quite glad to debate which is better for people, keeping them trapped in poverty or giving them a helping hand so they can actually enter the world of work and learn how to earn a living.
You also took shots in that speech to the Republican Jewish Coalition at what you call the unionized bureaucracy in the immigration service that can find 11 to 13 million illegal immigrants. Do you think busting the unions is the key to better immigration enforcement?
I think requiring that systems work and are competent without regard to work rules and without regard to rigid contracts that protect people who aren't doing their job is important. I think, for example, Chancellor Joel Klein is doing right here in New York City in signing contracts that are incentivized contracts for principals, where if they do a great job, they get a bonus. If they don't do a great job, they lose money. I think that kind of an incentivized, merit-oriented system is essential. I think you can have a union doing that. I recently was privileged to be invited by the Service Employees International Union to meet with their board, and I said it's very important for us to function in the 21st century that we find a unionization, a union movement committed to efficiency, committed to productivity, committed to having American workers be the most competitive in the world. And if we don't do that, we are not going to be able to survive in the 21st century.
On green conservatism, briefly, do you think, if you agree with the IPCC's warnings about how serious global warming might be and how serious the actions need to be to deal with it, do you think we can get there through the market, or don't companies need to be told what to do or have some kind of total carbon limits or something like that?
Look, I think that there is zero evidence that a Washington-based regulatory bureaucracy is effective at changing America. If you look at Superfund, for example, we spend an amazing amount of the money spent on Superfund cleanups on lawyers, litigation, red tape, and bureaucracy, when we ought to be spending it on engineers and on companies that actually clean up the mess and get the land back into productive use.
But haven't some of the limits and things like the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act really made a difference in cleaning the environment over these few decades?
I think setting a standard for clean water for public health reasons is a very sound thing to do. And I'm a Theodore Roosevelt Republican. I think that there are times when government, for example, on safety regulation for airlines, ought to be very, very tough about safety regulation, but should not try to run the airlines. Similarly, I would argue that we want to incentivize. I would much rather have a large tax credit to encourage the auto companies and make sure they had the resources to produce cars that are dramatically more efficient and put dramatically less carbon in the atmosphere. And I think you'll get there faster with a tax break and incentivizing the right behavior than you will by having a regulatory regime, which, frankly, the current American automakers wouldn't be able to find the capital to meet anyway.
So I know you have to go in a minute. Answer two things for me. One, what will make up your mind for you whether to enter the presidential race or not? And two, I'm here in New York City, which went 75% for Kerry and Gore. How much do you think you could bring New Yorkers into your Ideas Coalition?
Well, I think, first of all, we can bring lots of New Yorkers into the Ideas Coalition because ideas aren't automatically partisan. People who have better ideas for education, better ideas for energy, better ideas for the environment, we're interested in anybody anywhere, and I think that that's always been true. And some of the great institutions of America are right here in New York, so we certainly look for ideas in New York City and don't think you ought to write off anywhere in America. In fact, that's why we describe American solutions, not Republican solutions, not conservative solutions, American solutions. And I think most New Yorkers want to see a stronger, healthier, better America, too. So I see every reason to reach out to New York City and to try to find ideas here. As to whether or not to run, after we do our workshops for American Solutions on September 27th and September 29th, which will be on the Internet, available to everybody in the country, Democrat, Republican, and Independent, aimed at all 511,000 local elected officials, school board, city council, county commission, state legislature. Then on the 30th of September, I'll look at the presidential race, but I'm not going to look at it a day before then, because I think it's an absurdity to have people running around a year and a half before they're going to get sworn into office, spending all their time trying to pander to people and convince them to hire them for a job that doesn't start until January of 2009.
Newt Gingrich's new novel is Pearl Harbor, a novel of December 8th. He's making two bookstore appearances in our area tonight at 7:30 at the Borders, 290 Commons Way in Bridgewater, tomorrow night at 7 at the Barnes & Noble, 2245 Richmond Avenue on Staten Island. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We have a few minutes for your reactions to Newt Gingrich. He put a lot on the table there. Green environmentalism, debate solutions, comparisons as he sees them between Pearl Harbor and 9/11 and anti-terror preparedness. Your reactions, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org.